beds, in the semi-privacy that Homer Wells associated with a hospital ward. Unpainted plywood shelves between the beds formed primitive but stable wardrobe closets, which contained those twisted goosenecked reading lamps wherever there was the occasional electrical outlet. The furniture was shabby but neat, as if rescued or rejected from hospitals and offices, where it had been exposed to relentless but considerate use. This wing of the cider house had the functional economy of a military barracks, but it had too many personal touches to be institutional. There were curtains, for example, and Homer could tell that they would have been adequate, if faded, at the Worthingtons' dining-room windows, which was where they'd come from. Homer also recognized a particularly exaggerated peacefulness in a few of the flowery landscape paintings and animal portraits that were hung on the plasterboard walls. In such unlikely places, at times too high, at times too low, that Homer was sure they'd been hung to hide holes. Maybe boot holes, maybe fist holes, perhaps whole head holes. There seemed to Homer Wells to radiate from the room a kind of dormitory anger and apprehension he recognized from his nearly 20 years in the boys' division at St. Cloud's. "What is this place?" he asked Meanie Hyde, the rain pelting on the tin roof above them. "The cider house," said Meanie. "But who sleeps here? Who stays here? Do people live here?" Homer asked. It was remarkably clean, yet the atmosphere of use was so prevalent, Homer was reminded of the old bunk rooms in St. Cloud's where the woodsmen and sawyers had dreamed out their exhausted lives. "It's crew quarters for the pickers," Meanie Hyde said. "During the harvest, the pickers stay here, the migrants." "It's for the colored folks," said Big Dot Taft, plopping down the mops and pails. "Every year we make it nice for them. We wash everything and we give everything a fresh coat of paint." "I got to wax the press boards," Meanie Hyde said, sliding away from what he thought was the women's work, although Homer and Wally would perform it regularly most of the rainy days of the summer. "Negroes?" Homer Wells asked. "The pickers are Negroes?" "Black as night, some of them," said Florence Hyde. "They're okay." "They're nice," called Meanie Hyde. "Some of them are nicer than others," said Big Dot Taft. "Like other people I know," Irene Titcomb said, giggling, hiding her scar. "They're nice because Mrs. Worthington is nice to them," Meanie yelled from the spattered vicinity of the cider press. The building smelled like vinegar, old cider that had turned. It was a strong smell, but there was nothing stifling or unclean about it. Deborah Pettigrew smiled at Homer over the bucket they were sharing. He cautiously returned her smile while wondering where Wally was working today, in the rain, and imagining Ray Kendall at work. Ray would either be out on the choppy sea in his glistening sou'wester, or else working on the wiring of the International Harvester in the building called Number 2. Grace Lynch was scrubbing the linoleum counters in the kitchen of the cider house. Homer marveled that he had not noticed her there before, that he hadn't even known she was part of their crew. Louise Toby, sucking a cigarette down to its nub and flicking the butt out the picking crew quarters door, remarked that her mop wringer was out of joint. "It's jammed or something," Squeeze Louise said crossly. "Louise's mop-ringer is out of joint," Big Dot Taft said mockingly. "Poor Louise! Jammed your mop-ringer, huh?" said Florence Hyde, who laughed, which caused Big Dot Taft to roar. "Oh, cut it out," Louise said. She kicked a mop-ringer. "What's going on out there?" called Meanie Hyde. "Louise has got an overworked ringer," said Big Dot Taft. Homer looked at Louise, who was cross. Then he looked at Deborah Pettigrew, who blushed. "Are you overusing your poor ringer, Louise?" Irene Titcomb asked. "Louise, you must be sticking too many mops in your ringer, darling," said Florence Hyde. "Be nice, all of you," cried Meanie Hyde. "Too much of one mop, that's for sure," said Big Dot Taft. Even Louise found that funny. When she looked at Homer Wells, he looked away. Deborah Pettigrew was watching him, so he looked away from her, too. When Herb Fowler came by at the lunch break, he walked into the cider house and said, "Phew! You can smell niggers in here a whole year later." "I think it's just vinegar," Meanie Hyde said. "You telling me you can't smell niggers?" Herb Fowler asked. "You smell 'em?" Herb asked Louise. She shrugged. "How about you?" Herb asked Homer. "Can't you smell 'em?"
"I can smell vinegar, old apples, old cider," Homer said.
He saw the rubber sailing toward him in time to catch it. "You know what niggas do with those?" Herb asked him. He flipped another rubber to Louise Toby, who caught it without the slightest effort. She expected prophylactics to be flying in her direction hourly. "Show 'em what a nigger does with those, Louise," Herb said. The other women were bored. They'd seen this demonstration all their lives. Deborah Pettigrew looked nervously at Homer Wells and deliberately away from Louise. Louise herself seemed nervous and bored at the same time. She ripped the rubber out of its wrapper and stuck her index finger in it. Her fingernail poked out the rubber, her nail's fine edge next to the nipple-like end. "One year I told the niggers that they should just stick their joints into these rubbers if they didn't want to be catching diseases and having any new babies," Herb said. She grabbed Louise's finger in the rubber sheath and held it out for everyone to see. "And the next year, all the niggers told me that the rubbers didn't work. They said they stuck their fingers in there like I showed them, and they still got diseases and new babies every time they turned around." No one laughed. No one believed it. It was an old joke to all of them, except to Homer Wells, and the idea of people having babies every time they turned around was not especially funny to Homer. When Herb Fowler offered to drive them all to the diner on Drinkwater Road for a hot lunch, Homer said he didn't want to go. Mrs. Worthington made his lunch and Wally's every morning, and Homer felt obliged to eat his. He always enjoyed it. He also knew the crew was not supposed to leave the orchards for a lunch break, especially not in any of the Ocean View vehicles, and Herb Fowler was driving the green van that Olive used most often. It wasn't a hard rule, but Homer knew that if Wally had been working in the cider house, Herb wouldn't have suggested it. Homer ate his lunch appropriately in the cider house kitchen. When he glanced into the long room with the two rows of narrow beds, he thought how much the rolled mattresses and blankets resembled people sleeping there, except the shapes upon the iron beds were too still to be sleepers. "They are like bodies waiting to be identified," thought Homer Wells. Even though it was raining, he went outside to look at the collection of dead cars and junked tractor and trailer parts that festooned the dirt driveway in front of the cider house. In the back was a churned-up area of discolored weeds where the mash or the pumice was flung after the press. A pig farmer from Waldeboro drove all the way just to have it, Meanie Hyde had told Homer. The mash was great for pigs. Some of the dead cars had South Carolina plates. Homer Wells had never looked at a map of the United States. He had seen a globe, but it was a crude one. The states weren't marked. He knew South Carolina was a long way south. The Negroes came from there in trucks, Meanie Hyde had said, or they drove their own cars. But some of their cars were so old and beaten up that they died here. Meanie wasn't sure how all the Negroes got back to South Carolina. "They pick grapefruits down in Florida, I think," Meanie said, "and peaches when it's peach time somewhere else, and apples here. They travel around just picking things." Homer watched a seagull that was watching him from the roof of the cider house. The gull was so drawn in upon itself that Homer was reminded it was raining and went back inside. He rolled down one of the mattresses and stretched out on it, placing both the pillow and the blanket under his head. Something invited him to smell the blanket and the pillow, but he could detect nothing more than the aura of vinegar, and a scent he categorized as simply old. The blanket and pillow felt more human than they smelled, but the deeper he pushed his face into them, the more human their smell became. He thought about the strain on Louise Toby's face, and how her finger had stretched itself out in the rubber, and the way her nail had looked ready to slice through. He recalled the mattress in the Sawyer's Lodge in St. Cloud's, where Melanie had introduced him to the way he felt now. He took himself out of his work jeans and masturbated quickly, the springs of the old iron bed creaking sharply. Something in his vision seemed clearer after he had finished. When he sat up on the bed, he spotted the other body that had taken the liberty of resting in the cider house. Even with her body curled so tightly in upon itself, like the gull in the rain, or like a fetus, or like a woman with cramps, Homer had no trouble recognizing Grace Lynch. Even if she hadn't been watching him, even if she'd never been turned in his direction, she surely could not have mistaken the rhythm of the old bed springs, or even, Homer thought, the detectable sharpness of the odor of the semen he cupped in his hand. He stepped quietly outdoors and held his hand out in the rain. The seagull, still huddled on the cider house roof, took a sudden interest in him. There was a history of successful scavenging associated with this place. When Homer went back in the cider house, he saw that Grace Lynch had fixed her mattress the way it had been, and was standing by the window with her face pressed into the curtain. He had to look twice to see Grace Lynch. He wouldn't have seen her standing there if he hadn't already known she was in the room. "I've been there," Grace Lynch said softly, without looking at Homer. "Where you come from," she explained. "I've been there. I don't know how you managed a night's sleep." Her thinness was especially sharp, even knife-like, in what dead gray light the rainy day provided at that window. She drew the faded curtain around her narrow shoulders like a shawl. She wouldn't look at Homer Wells, and nothing in her brittle, shivering stance could have been interpreted as beckoning. Yet Homer felt himself drawn to her, in the way we are urged, especially in gloomy weather, to seek the familiar. In St. Cloud's, one grew accustomed to victims, and the attitude of a victim shone stronger than reflected sunlight from Grace Lynch. Homer felt such a contradictory glow shining forth from her that he was impelled to go to her and hold her limp, damp hands. "Funny," she whispered, still not looking at him. "It was so awful there, but I felt real safe." She put her head on his chest and stuck her sharp knee between his legs, twisting her bony hip into him. "Not like here," she whispered. "It's dangerous here." Her thin bony hand slipped into his pants, as skittish as a lizard. The noisy arrival of the green van containing the escapees, to a hot lunch, saved him. Like a startled cat, Grace sprang crazily away from him. When they all came through the door, she was digging the grit from a seam in the linoleum on the kitchen counter, using a wire brush that Homer hadn't noticed she'd had in her hip pocket. Like so much of Grace Lynch, it had been concealed. But the tension in the look she gave him at quitting time, when he rode back to the Apple Mart on Big Dot Taft's jolly lap, was enough to tell Homer Wells that whatever was dangerous had not deserted Grace Lynch, and that he could travel far, but never so far that the victims of St. Cloud's would ever desert him. The night after Grace Lynch attacked him, Homer had his first date with Deborah Pettigrew. It was also the first time he went to the drive-in movie with Candy and Wally. They all went in Senior's Cadillac. Homer and Deborah Pettigrew sat in the splotched back seat where only a couple of months ago poor Curly Day had lost control of himself. Homer was unaware that the purpose of drive-in movies was, ultimately, for losing control of oneself in the back seats of cars. "Homer's never been to a drive-in before," Wally announced to Deborah Pettigrew when they picked her up. The Pettigrews were a large family who kept dogs, many dogs, mostly chained. Some were chained to the bumpers of the several undriven, believed-to-be-dead cars that so permanently occupied the front lawn that the grass grew through the drive shafts and the axle bearings. As Homer stepped gingerly around the snapping dogs en route to Deborah's front door, the dogs lunged against the unbudging cars. The Pettigrews were a large family in both numbers and in flesh. Deborah's fetching chubbiness was but a slight reminder of the family's potential for girth. At the door, Deborah's mother greeted Homer massively. She of the monstrous genes responsible for the likes of Deborah's sister, Big Dot Taft. "Deborah!" shrieked Deborah's mother. "It's your beau!" "Hi, sweetie pie," she said to Homer. "I've heard all about how nice you are and what good manners you've got. Please excuse the mess." Deborah, blushing beside her, tried to hurry Homer outside as forcefully as her mother wished to usher him in. He glimpsed several huge people, some with remarkably swollen faces, as if they'd lived half their lives under water or had survived incredible beatings, all with wide, friendly smiles, which contradicted the untold viciousness of the dogs barking in such a frenzy at Homer's back. "We have to go, Mom," Deborah whined, shoving Homer out the door. "We can't be late."
"Late for what?"
someone cackled from the house, which shook with heavy laughter. Coughs followed, which were followed by labored sighing before the dogs erupted in such force that Homer thought the noise of them would be sufficient to keep him and Deborah from ever reaching the Cadillac.
"Shut up!"
Deborah yelled at the dogs. They all stopped, but only for a second. When Wally said, "Homer's never been to a drive-in before," He had to shout to be heard over the dogs. "I've never been to a movie before," Homer admitted.
"Gosh," said Deborah Pettigrew.
She smelled nice. She was much neater and cleaner than she looked in her Apple Mart clothes. Deborah dressed with a certain pert orderliness for working, too. Her chubbiness was restrained, and as they drove to Cape Kenneth, her usual good nature emerged so warmly that even her shyness disappeared. She was a fun girl, as they say in Maine. She was nice-looking, relaxed, good-humored, hard-working, and not very smart. Her prospects, at best, included marriage to someone pleasant and not a great deal older or smarter than herself. In the summers, the Pettigrews occupied one of the new houses on the overcrowded, mucky shore of Drinkwater Lake. They'd managed to make the new place look lived in, on its rapid way to ramshackle, almost instantly. The lawn had appeared to grow its dead cars overnight, and the dogs had survived the move from the Pettigrews' winter house in Kenneth Corners without losing a bit of their territorial savagery. Like all the cottages around Drinkwater Lake, the Pettigrews had been named, as if the houses themselves were orphans, delivered incomplete and in need of further creation. The Pettigrews' house was named All of Us! Exclamation point.
"The exclamation point is what kills me," Wally had said to Homer when they pulled up at the car and dog lot, "as if they're proud of their overpopulation."
But Wally was very respectful once Deborah joined them in the car. This mannerism of what he'd seen of society struck Homer Wells quite forcefully. People, even nice people, because surely Wally was nice, would say a host of critical things about someone to whom they would then be perfectly pleasant. At St. Cloud's, criticism was plainer, and harder, if not impossible, to conceal. The drive-in movie in Cape Kenneth was nearly as new to Maine as the Haven Club's heated pool, and was a lot less practical. Drive-in movies would never be a great idea for Maine. The night fog along the coast lent to many a joyful film the inappropriately ghoulish atmosphere of a horror movie. In later years, people groping for restrooms in the snack bar would fail to find their cars when they attempted to return to them. The other problem was mosquitoes. In 1940-something, when Homer Wells went to his first drive-in movie, the hum of the mosquitoes in the night air of Cape Kenneth was far more audible than the soundtrack. Wally was relatively successful in preventing the mosquitoes from taking over the car, because he always brought with him an aerosol pump sprayer, with which he frequently doused the car, and the air surrounding the cars. The pump can was loaded with the insecticide they sprayed the apples with. Thus the air in and surrounding the Cadillac was rendered poisonous and foul, but fairly free of mosquitoes. The hiss and stench of the spray aroused frequent complaints from Wally's fellow moviegoers in the cars nearest the Cadillac, until they were being bitten so badly by mosquitoes that they stopped protesting. Some of them politely asked if they could borrow the device for the purpose of poisoning their own cars. There was no snack bar at the Cape Kenneth drive-in in 1940-something, and there were no restrooms. The men and boys took turns urinating against a dank cement wall at the rear end of the drive-in pit. Atop the wall were perched several small and uncouth boys, Cape Kenneth locals, too young or too poor for cars, who used the wall to watch the movie even though they were well beyond the possibility of hearing it. Occasionally, when the movie was dissatisfying, they peed from the top of the wall onto the luckless people who were peeing against it. Girls and women were not expected to pee at the drive-in, and consequently were better behaved than the men and boys. The women drank less, for example, although their behavior inside the cars could not be monitored. It was wondrous, this whole experience, for Homer Wells. He was especially acute at noticing what human beings did for pleasure. What, there could be no mistake about it, they chose to do. Because he had come from a place where choice was not so evident, and examples of people performing for pleasure were not plentiful. It amazed him that people suffered drive-in movies by choice and for pleasure, but he believed that if he failed to see the fun in it, it was entirely his fault. What he was most unprepared for was the movie itself. After people honked their horns and blinked their headlights and exhibited other less endearing forms of impatience, Homer heard what was unmistakably the sound of someone vomiting against a fender. A gigantic image filled the sky. "It is something's mouth," thought Homer Wells. The camera backed away, or rather lurched away. "Something's head, a kind of horse," thought Homer Wells. It was a camel, actually,
but Homer Wells had never seen a camel or a picture of one. He thought it was a horribly deformed horse, a mutant horse, perhaps some ghastly fetus phase of a horse. The camera staggered back farther. Mounted by the camel's grotesque hump was a black-skinned man almost entirely concealed in white wrapping. Bandages, thought Homer Wells. The ferocious black Arab nomad brandished a frightening curved sword. Whacking the lumbering camel with the flat of the blade, he drove the beast into a faulty, staggering gallop across such endless sand dunes that the animal and its rider were soon only a speck on the vast horizon. Suddenly, music! Homer jumped. Words! The titles, the names of the actors were written in the sand by an invisible hand. What was that? Homer asked Wally. He meant the animal, its rider, the desert, the credits, everything. Some dumb Bedouin, I think, Wally said. A Bedouin, thought Homer Wells. It's a kind of horse? He asked. What horse? Asked Deborah Pettigrew. The animal, Homer said, sensing his mistake. Candy turned around in the front seat and looked at Homer with heartbreaking affection. That's a camel, Homer, she said.
You've never seen a camel? Wally shouted.
Well, where would he see a camel? Candy snapped at him.
I was just surprised, Wally said defensively.
I've never seen a Negro either, Homer said. That was one, wasn't it, on the camel?
A Negro Bedouin, I guess, Wally said.
Gosh, said Deborah Pettigrew, who looked at Homer a little fearfully, as if she suspected him of simultaneously existing on another planet in another life form. Then the credits were over. The black man on the camel was gone and would never be seen again. The desert was also gone. Apparently it had served its uncertain function. It would never be seen again either. It was a pirate movie. Great ships were blasting each other with cannons. Swarthy men with uncut hair and baggy pants were doing terrible things to nicer-looking men who were better dressed. None of the men was black. Perhaps the camel's rider had been a kind of omen, thought Homer Wells. His exposure to storytelling, through Charles Dickens and Charlotte Bronte, had ill-prepared him for characters who came from and traveled nowhere, or for stories that made no sense. The pirates stole a chest of coins and a blonde woman from the ship of pleasanter aspect before they sank the ship and sailed away in their own foul vessel, on which they coarsely attempted to make merry with drunkenness and song. They appeared to enjoy leering at the woman and taunting her, but some mysterious and totally unseen force kept them from actually harming her, for a whole hour, during which they harmed nearly everyone else and many of themselves. The woman, however, was reserved for more teasing, yet she protested her fate bitterly, and Homer had the feeling that he was supposed to lament for her. A man who apparently adored the complaining woman pursued her across the ocean, through burning harbor towns and charmless inns of suggested but never visualized lewdness. As the fog rolled in, there was much of the movie that was never visualized, although Homer remained riveted to the image in the sky. He was only partially aware that Wally and Candy were uninterested in the movie. They were slumped from sight in the front seat, and only occasionally did Candy's hand appear, gripping, or lolling on, the back of the seat. Twice Homer heard her say, "No, Wally," once with a firmness he had never heard in her voice before. Wally's frequent laughter continued at intervals, and he whispered and murmured and gurgled in his throat. Homer was occasionally aware of Deborah Pettigrew being less interested in the pirate movie than he was. When he looked at her, he was surprised to find her looking at him. Not critically, but not very affectionately either. She appeared to be more and more amazed to see him as the picture went on and on. Once she touched his hand, he thought she wanted something and regarded her politely. She just stared at him. He looked back at the movie. The blonde woman was forever barring her door against her captors, and they were always breaking into her room despite her efforts. They seemed to break into her room for the single purpose of demonstrating to her that she couldn't bar them out. Once in the room, they taunted her in the usual fashion and then retreated, whereupon she attempted to bar their way again. "I think I've missed something," Homer Wells announced after more than an hour had passed. Candy sat up in the front seat and looked at him, her genuine concern quite apparent, despite the wild tangle her hair was in. "What have you missed?" Wally asked, sleepily, Homer thought. Deborah Pettigrew, prettily, leaned close to Homer and whispered in his ear.
"I think you've missed me," she said. "I think you've forgotten I'm here."
Homer had meant he'd missed something in the story. He stared at Deborah in a particularly uncomprehending way. Deborah kissed him, very neatly, very dryly, on his mouth. She sat back in the seat and smiled at him.
"Your turn," she said.
Wally at this moment opened the front door and sprayed lethal fumes all around the Cadillac, much of the stuff drifting back into the open door. Candy and Wally, and Deborah too, coughed in a very dramatic fashion, but Homer stared at Deborah Pettigrew. The idea of the drive-in movie slowly coming to him. He cautiously kissed Deborah on her dry little mouth. She kissed him back. He settled himself more comfortably beside her, and she put her head on his shoulder, one hand on his chest. He put one hand on her chest, but she pushed it away. He knew he was still missing something, but he proceeded tentatively to discover the rules. He kissed her neck. This was acceptable. She snuggled against his neck, and something new and daring and wet licked him at the throat. Her tongue. Homer permitted his tongue to venture into the poisoned air. He took a moment, contemplating the uses of his tongue. He decided to kiss her on her mouth and to suggest gently the application of his tongue there. But this was somewhat tensely rejected. Her own tongue pushed his away. Her teeth blocked further entry. He was beginning to see it was a yes-no set of rules he had encountered. He was permitted to rub her tummy, but not to touch her breasts. The hand on her hips was allowed to remain there. The hand on her thigh in her lap was moved on. She put her arms around him and hugged him. Her kisses were friendly and sweet. He began to feel like a well-treated pet, certainly better treated than most of the Pettigrew dogs. "No," Candy said, so loudly that both Homer and Deborah Pettigrew flinched. Then Deborah giggled and cuddled against him. By straining his neck and rolling his eyes toward the back of his head, Homer Wells could manage to see the movie. At last, the tireless lover had tracked the blonde woman to yet another place of bondage. The stupid woman had barred herself in again, but this time she was attempting to keep herself untouched by her rescuer. It was quite frustrating to watch him hack and flail at her door. From one of the cars in the hazardous fog around them, someone yelled, "Leave her!" Another person cried, "Kill her!" All Homer felt sure of was that no one would ever fuck her. She seemed protected from both sex and death by something as shifty as the Cape Kenneth fog. Nor would any of them in the Cadillac pursue much adventure beyond the pleasure afforded to cherished household pets. This feeling caused Homer to remember the affection Dr. Larch had for him, and Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela had for him, too. When the movie was over, he realized he was crying. He realized that although he loved where he was, he loved Dr. Larch more than anyone else. At this point in his life, he still loved Larch more than he loved Candy. And he realized that he missed Larch, too, while at the same time he hoped he would never again set foot in St. Cloud's. It was an overwhelming confusion that inspired his weeping, but Deborah Pettigrew mistook the cause. She thought the movie had moved him to tears. "There, there," she said in a mothering tone, hugging him. Candy and Wally leaned over the front seat. Candy touched his head.
"It's okay. You can cry. I cry at lots of movies," she said.
Even Wally was deeply respectful.
"Hey, buddy," he said, "we know this must all be a shock to you."
"His poor heart," sweet Wally was thinking. "You dear boy," Candy thought, "please watch out for your heart."
She put her cheek against Homer's cheek and kissed him near his ear. It was a very sudden surprise to her how much she enjoyed that kiss of friendship. It surprised Homer Wells, too. Despite the little dry kisses that Deborah Pettigrew gave him in abundance, he felt a remarkable difference surge through him at the instant of Candy's kissing him. It was a feeling that rushed him from nowhere, and he knew, looking at Wally's fond and handsome face, that it was a feeling with nowhere to go. Was that what love was and how it came to you, leaving you no options for its use? Like the black-skinned nomad on the camel, where did he belong in a movie about pirates?
"I am that black-skinned rider on that camel," thought the orphan, Homer Wells.
What was he called? Later, after he'd taken Deborah Pettigrew home and had nearly been eaten by her dogs, he asked Wally. Homer sat up in front in the Cadillac, Candy in the middle of the seat between them. "A Bedouin," Wally said. "I'm a Bedouin," thought Homer Wells. When Candy fell asleep, she slumped against Wally's shoulder, but this bothered his driving. He pushed her very gently in Homer's direction. The rest of the way to Hart's Haven, she slept with her head on Homer's shoulder, her hair lightly touching his face. When they got to Ray Kendall's lobster pound, Wally shut off the car and whispered, "Hey, sleepy." He kissed Candy on the lips, which woke her up. She sat bolt upright, for a second disoriented, and she looked accusingly at both Wally and Homer, as if she weren't sure which one of them had kissed her. "Easy," Wally said to her, laughing. "You're home." Home, thought Homer Wells. He knew that for the Bedouin, come from nowhere, going nowhere, there was no home. In August of that same summer, another Bedouin left what had been home for him. Curly Day departed St. Cloud's for Booth Bay, where a young druggist and his wife had recently moved and had plunged into a life of community service. Dr. Larch had his doubts about the young couple, but he had more doubts regarding Curly Day's resilience to another winter in St. Cloud's. The end of the summer was the last good time for visits from adoptive families. The good weather in the early fall was brief, and Curly's general positivism had been in decline since the departure of Homer Wells. Curly could never be convinced that Homer had not somehow stolen the beautiful couple whom a kinder fate had intended for him. The druggist and his wife were not a beautiful couple. They were well off and good-hearted, but they had not been born to a life of ease, and it seemed unlikely that they would ever adjust to anything resembling gracious living. They had striven to their station in life, and their idea of helping their fellow man seemed rooted in the notion that their fellow man should be taught how to strive. They had requested an older orphan. They wanted someone capable of doing a few hours' work in the drugstore after school. They saw their childlessness as entirely God's decision and agreed that God had meant for them to find a foundling and educate him in the methods of self-support and self-improvement, for which the foundling would be broadly rewarded by inheriting the young couple's pharmacy, and with it the means to care for them in their apparently eagerly anticipated old age. They were practical and Christian people, albeit grim, when they reviewed for Larch their earlier efforts to have a child of their own. Before he met the couple, at a time when he had only corresponded with them by mail, Larch had hoped he might persuade them to allow Curly to keep his first name. When an orphan gets to be as old as Curly, Larch argued, the name has more than casual significance. But Larch's hopes sank when he saw the couple. The young man was prematurely bald, so perfectly bald that Larch wondered if the fellow had not suffered from the application of an untested pharmaceutical product, and the young wife's hair was fine and lank. The couple seemed shocked at the wealth of Curly Day's curly hair, and Larch imagined that their first family trip would probably include a visit to the barber. Curly himself seemed as unenthusiastic about the couple as the couple were unenthusiastic about his name, yet he wanted to leave St. Cloud's, badly. Larch saw that the boy still hoped for an adoption as dazzling as the one he'd imagined, for a couple as glittering with the promise of another life as Candy and Wally were. Of the very plain young couple from Booth Bay, Curly Day said to Dr. Larch, "They're okay. They're nice, I guess. And Booth Bay is on the coast. I think I'd like the ocean." Larch did not say to the boy that the couple adopting him did not appear to be a boating couple, or a beach couple, or even a fishing off a dock couple. He suspected them of thinking that a life of playing with or on the sea was frivolous, something for tourists. Larch thought that way himself. Larch expected that the drugstore remained open every daylight hour of the summer, and that the hard-working young couple remained in the store every minute, selling tanning oil to summer people while they themselves stayed as pale as the winter and were proud of it. "You can't be too choosy, Wilbur," Nurse Edna said. "If the boy gets sick, there'll be lots of pills and cough medicines around." "He'll still be Curly to me," Nurse Angela said defiantly. Worse, Larch imagined. He'll always be Curly to Curly. But Larch let him go.
It was high time for him to be gone. That was the main reason. The couple's name was Rinfret. They called Curly Roy. And so Roy Curly Rinfret took up residence in Booth Bay. Rinfret's pharmacy was a harborfront store. The family lived several miles inland where the sea was out of sight. But not out of scent, Mrs. Rinfret had maintained. She declared that when the wind was right, the ocean could be smelled from the house. Not with Curly's nose, Dr. Larch imagined. Curly's nose was such a constant streamer, Dr. Larch suspected that Curly had no sense of smell at all. "Let us be happy for Curly Day," Dr. Larch announced to the boys' division one evening in August 1940-something, over David Copperfield's steady sobs. "Curly Day has found a family," Dr. Larch said. "Good night, Curly."
"Good night, Burley," young Copperfield cried.
When Homer Wells received the letter telling him the news of Curly's adoption, he read it again and again, in the moonlight streaming through Wally's window while Wally slept. A druggist, thought Homer Wells. He'd been upset enough by the news to talk about it with Wally and Candy. They'd sat in the moonlight earlier that evening, throwing snails off Ray Kendall's dock. Plunk, plunk, went the periwinkles. Homer Wells talked and talked. He told them about the litany. "Let us be happy for Curly Day," and so forth. He tried to explain how it had felt to be addressed as a prince of Maine, as a king of New England. "I guess I imagined someone who looked like you," Homer said to Wally. Candy remembered that Dr. Larch had said this to her, too, that he'd told her that her babies would be these princes, these kings. "But I didn't know what he meant," she said. "I mean, he was nice, but it was unimaginable." "It still is unimaginable to me," Wally said. "I mean, what you saw," he said to Homer, "what all of you imagined, it must have been different for each of you." Wally was unwilling to accept the notion that someone who looked like himself would ever be adequate to the expression. "It sounds a little mocking," Candy said. "I just can't see what he meant." "Yeah," Wally agreed. "It sounds a little cynical." "Maybe it was," said Homer Wells. "Maybe he said it for himself and not for us." He told them about Melanie, but not everything about her. He took a deep breath and told them about Fuzzy Stone. He imitated the breathing contraption admirably. He had them both so roaring with laughter at the racket he was making that they drowned out the insignificant ploink of the snails dropping into the sea. Wally and Candy didn't know they were at the end of the story until Homer simply arrived at it. "Fuzzy Stone has found a new family," he repeated to them. "Good night, Fuzzy," he concluded hollowly. There wasn't a sound then, not even a snail. The sea lapped at the dock posts. The boats moored around them rocked in the water. When a line was pulled taut and yanked out of the water, you could hear the water drip off the line. When the thicker ropes were stretched, they made a noise like grinding teeth. "Curly Day was the first boy I circumcised," Homer Wells announced, just to change the subject from Fuzzy Stone. "Dr. Larch was there when I did it," Homer said, "and a circumcision is no big deal. It's really easy." Wally felt his own penis inch toward itself like a snail. Candy felt a cramp knot in her calf, and she stopped swinging her legs off the edge of the dock. She drew her heels up to her buttocks and hugged her knees. "Curly was the first one," Homer said. "I made it a little lopsided," he confessed. "We could drive up to Booth Bay and see how he's doing," Wally suggested. "What would we see?" Candy wondered. She imagined Curly peeing all over the Cadillac again and telling them again that he was the best one. "I don't think that would be a good idea," Homer said. He went with Wally back to Ocean View and wrote Dr. Larch a long letter, his longest so far. He tried to tell Larch about the drive-in movie, but the letter degenerated into a critique of the movie itself, and so he tried to change the subject. Should he tell him about Herb Fowler carrying all the prophylactics? Although Dr. Larch approved of everyone using prophylactics, he would hardly have approved of Herb Fowler. Should he tell Larch that he had learned the real purpose of the drive-in? Wasn't it to tease oneself and one's date into a state of sexual frenzy, which neither of you were allowed to act upon? Dr. Larch would certainly not think highly of that. Should he tell Dr. Larch what Grace Lynch had said and done, or how he dreamed about her, or how he imagined he was falling in love, or already had fallen in love with Candy, which he knew was forbidden. "And how do I say, 'I miss you,' he wondered, when I don't mean I want to come back?" And so he ended the letter in his fashion. He ended it in exactly, "I remember when you kissed me," he wrote to Dr. Larch. "I wasn't really asleep." Yes, thought Dr. Larch, I remember that too. He rested in the dispensary. Why didn't I kiss him more? Why not all the time? In other parts of the world, he dreamed, they have drive-in movies. He always used more ether than he should have before the annual meeting of St. Cloud's Board of Trustees. He'd never quite understood what a Board of Trustees was for, and his impatience with the routine inquiries was growing. In the old days, there'd been the Maine State Board of Medical Examiners. They'd never asked him any questions. They never wanted to hear from him. Now it appeared to Wilbur Larch that there was a Board of Trustees for everything. This year, there were two new board members who'd never before seen the orphanage, and so the meeting had been scheduled to take place in St. Cloud's. The board usually met in Portland. The new members wanted to see the place. The old members agreed they should refresh themselves with the atmosphere. It was a perfect August morning, with more indications of September in the air's crispness than there were indications of the stifling carryover of July's humidity and hazy heat. But Larch was irritable. "I don't know exactly what a drive-in movie is," he said crossly to Nurse Angela. "Homer doesn't say exactly." Nurse Angela looked frustrated. "No, he doesn't," she agreed, going over the letter again and again. "What do you do with your cars when you're watching the movie?" Nurse Edna asked. "I don't know," Dr. Larch said. "I assume that if you drive into something to see the movie, you must stay in your cars." "But what do you drive into, Wilbur?" Nurse Edna asked. "That's what I don't know," Larch shouted. "Well, aren't we in a lovely mood?" Nurse Angela said. "Why would you want to bring your car to a movie in the first place?" Nurse Edna asked. "I don't know the answer to that either," Dr. Larch said tiredly. Unfortunately, he looked tired during the trustees' meeting, too. Nurse Angela tried to present some of the orphanage's priorities for him. She didn't want him to get bad-tempered with anyone on the board. The two new members seemed in an awful hurry to demonstrate that they already understood everything, and Nurse Angela detected Dr. Larch looking at these younger members with something of the look he had formerly reserved for Clara in the days when Larch would discover that Homer's cadaver hadn't been put away properly. The new woman on the board had been appointed for her abilities at fundraising. She was especially aggressive. She'd been married to a Congregationalist missionary who'd committed suicide in Japan, and she had returned to her home state of Maine with a zeal for putting her considerable energies to work for something doable. Japan had not been at all doable, she kept saying. Maine's problems, by comparison, were entirely surmountable. She believed that all Maine needed, or lacked, was organization, and she believed every solution began with new blood, a phrase, Nurse Angela observed, that caused Dr. Larch to pale as if his own blood were trickling away from him. "That's an unfortunate expression for those of us familiar with hospital work," Dr. Larch snapped once, but the woman, Mrs. Goodhall, did not look sufficiently bitten. Mrs. Goodhall expressed, albeit coldly, her admiration for the severity and the duration of Dr. Larch's undertaking, and her respect for how much experience Larch and his assistants had with administering St. Cloud's. Perhaps they all could be invigorated by a younger assistant. A young intern, a willing toiler, and with some new ideas in the obstetrical field, Mrs. Goodhall suggested. "I keep up with the field," Dr. Larch said, "and I keep up with the number of babies born here." "Well, then, how about a new administrative assistant?" Mrs. Goodhall suggested. "Leave the medical practice to you. I'm talking about someone with a grasp of some of the newer adoption procedures, or just someone who could handle the correspondence and the interviewing for you." "I could use a new typewriter," Dr. Larch said. "Just get me a new typewriter and you can keep the assistant, or give the assistant to someone who's really doddering around." The new man on the board was a psychiatrist.
He was rather new at psychiatry, which was rather new in Maine in 1940-something. His name was Gingrich. Even with people he had just met, he had a way of assuming he understood what pressure they were under. He was quite sure that everyone was under some pressure. Even if he was correct about the particular pressure you were under, and even if you agreed with him that there indeed was a certain pressure, and indeed you were under it, he had a way of assuming he knew other pressures that preyed upon you, which were always unseen by you. For example, had he seen the movie that began with the Bedouin on the camel, Dr. Gingrich might have assumed that the captive woman was under great pressure to marry someone, although it was clearly her opinion that all she wanted to do was get free. His eyes and introductory smile communicated a cloying sympathy that you perhaps did not deserve, as if he were imparting by the imposed gentleness of his voice and the slowness with which he spoke the assurance that everything is much more subtle than we can suppose. The older members of the board, all men, all as elderly as Larch, were intimidated by this new man who spoke in whispers and by this new woman who was so loud. In tandem, they seemed so sure of themselves. They viewed their new roles on the board not as learning experiences or even as an introduction to orphanage life, but as opportunities for taking charge. "Oh, dear," Nurse Edna thought. "There's going to be trouble, as if we need any," Nurse Angela thought. It wouldn't have hurt to have a young intern around, or an administrative assistant either. But she knew that Wilbur Larch was protecting his ability to perform the abortions. How could he accept new appointees without knowing the person's beliefs? "Now, Dr. Larch," Dr. Gingrich said softly, "surely you know we don't think of you as doddering." "Sometimes I think of myself as doddering," Larch said defensively. "I suppose you might think so, too." "The pressure you must be under," Dr. Gingrich said. "Someone with all your responsibilities should have all the help he can get."
"Someone with my responsibility should stay responsible," Larch said.
"With the pressure you must be under," said Dr. Gingrich, "it's no wonder you find it hard to delegate even a little of that responsibility."
"I have more use for a typewriter than for a delegate," Wilbur Larch said. But when he blinked his eyes, he saw those bright stars that populated both the clear May night and the firmament of ether, and he wasn't sure which stars they were. He rubbed his face with his hand and caught Mrs. Goodhall scribbling something on the impressively thick pad before her.
"Let's see," she said, sharply by comparison to Dr. Gingrich's wispy voice. "You're in your 70s now, is that correct? Aren't you 70-something?" she asked Dr. Larch.
"Right," said Wilbur Larch. 70-something.
"And how old is Mrs. Grogan?"
Mrs. Goodhall asked suddenly, as if Mrs. Grogan weren't present, or as if she were so old that she was incapable of answering for herself.
"I'm 62," Mrs. Grogan said pertly, "and I'm as lively as a spring chicken."
"Oh, no one doubts you're not lively," said Dr. Gingrich.
"And Nurse Angela?"
Mrs. Goodhall asked, not looking up at anyone. The scrutiny of her own writing on the pad before her required every ounce of her exhaustive attention.
"I'm 58, Nurse Angela said.
"Angela is as strong as an ox," Mrs. Grogan said.
"We don't doubt it," said Dr. Gingrich cheerfully.
"I'm 55 or 56, Nurse Edna offered, before the question was raised.
"You don't know how old you are?" Dr. Gingrich asked meaningfully.
"Actually," said Wilbur Larch, "we're all so senile we can't remember. We're just guessing." "But look at you," he said suddenly to Mrs. Goodhall, which did get Mrs. Goodhall to raise her eyes from her pad. "I guess you have such trouble remembering things," Larch said, "that you have to write everything down."
"I'm just trying to get the picture of what's going on here," Mrs. Goodhall said evenly.
"Well," Larch said, "I suggest you listen to me. I've been here long enough to have the picture pretty clearly in mind."
"It's very clear what a wonderful job you're doing," Dr. Gingrich told Dr. Larch. "It's also clear how hard a job it is."
Such a warm washcloth kind of sympathy was leaking from Dr. Gingrich that Larch felt wet and grateful that he wasn't sitting near enough to Dr. Gingrich for Dr. Gingrich to touch him. Gingrich was clearly a toucher.
"If it's not asking too much in the way of your support," Dr. Larch said, "I'd not only like a new typewriter, I'd like permission to keep the old one."
"I think we can arrange that," Mrs. Goodhall said.
Nurse Edna, who was not accustomed to sudden insights, or despite her year's hot flashes, and was completely inexperienced with the world of omens and signs, or even forewarnings, felt a totally foreign and breathtaking violence rise from her stomach. She found herself staring at Mrs. Goodhall with a hatred Nurse Edna couldn't conceive of feeling for another human being. "Oh, dear, the enemy," she thought. She had to excuse herself. She was sure she was going to be ill. She was, but discreetly, out of sight in the boys' shower room. Only David Copperfield, still mourning the departure of Curly Day and still struggling with the language, spotted her. "Mendna?" young Copperfield asked. "I'm fine, David," she told him, but she was not fine. "I have seen the end," she thought, with an unfamiliar bitterness. Larch had seen it, too. "Someone will replace me," he realized, "and it won't be long." He looked at his calendar. He had 2 abortions to perform the next day, and 3 probables near the end of the week. There were always those who just showed up, too. "And what if they get someone who won't perform one?" he thought. When the new typewriter arrived, it fit, just in time, into his plans for Fuzzy Stone. "Thank you for the new typewriter," Larch wrote to the Board of Trustees. It had arrived just in time, he added, because the old typewriter, which, if they remembered, he wanted to keep, had completely broken down. This was not true. He had the keys replaced on the old typewriter, and it now typed a story with a different face. What it typed were letters from young Fuzzy Stone. Fuzzy began by wanting Dr. Larch to know how much he was looking forward to being a doctor when he grew up, and how much Dr. Larch had inspired him to make this decision. "I doubt that I will ever come to feel as you do regarding abortion," young Fuzzy wrote to Dr. Larch. "Certainly it is obstetrics that interests me, and certainly your example is responsible for my interest, but I expect we shall never agree about abortion. Although I know you perform abortions out of the most genuine beliefs and out of the best intentions, you must permit me to honor my beliefs accordingly." And on and on. Larch covered the years. He wrote into the future, leaving a few convenient blanks. Larch completed Dr. F. Stone's training. He put him through medical school. He gave him fine obstetrical procedure. Even a few variances from Dr. Larch's procedure, which Dr. Larch had Dr. Stone describe. And always Fuzzy Stone remained faithful to his beliefs. "I'm sorry, but I believe there is a soul, and that it exists from the moment of conception," Fuzzy Stone wrote. He was slightly pompous-sounding as he grew up, close to unctuous in his graciousness toward Larch, even capable of condescension at times, the kind of patronizing a young man will indulge in when he thinks he has developed beyond his teacher. Larch gave Fuzzy Stone an unmistakable self-righteousness, which he imagined all supporters of the existing law against abortion would feel at home with. He even had young Dr. Stone propose that he replace Dr. Larch, "but not until you're ready to retire, of course," and that by this replacement it might be demonstrated to Dr. Larch that the law should be observed, that abortions should not be performed, and that a safe and informative view of family planning, birth control, and so forth, could in time achieve the desired effect, "without breaking the laws of God or man," wrote a convincingly creepy Fuzzy Stone. The desired effect, both Dr. Larch and Dr. Stone agreed, would be a minimum of unwanted children brought forth into the world. "I, for one, am happy to be here," crowed young Dr. Stone. "He sounds like a missionary," thought Wilbur Larch. The idea of making a missionary out of Fuzzy appealed to Dr. Larch for several reasons. Among them, Fuzzy wouldn't need a license to practice medicine if he took his magic to some remote and primitive place. It exhausted Larch, but he got it all down, one typewriter for Fuzzy that was used for nothing else, and the new one for himself. He made carbons of his own letters and referred to his dialogue with young Dr. Stone in various fragments, which he contributed to A Brief History of St. Clouds. He imagined that their correspondence ended, quite abruptly, when Larch refused to accept the idea that anyone should replace him who was unwilling to perform abortions. "I will go until I drop," he wrote to Fuzzy. "Here in St. Clouds, I will never allow myself to be replaced by some reactionary religious moron who cares more for the misgivings suffered in his own frail soul than for the actual suffering of countless unwanted and mistreated children. I am sorry you're a doctor," Larch ranted to poor Fuzzy. "I am sorry such training was wasted on someone who refuses to help the living because of a presumptuous point of view taken toward the unborn. You are not the proper doctor for this orphanage, and over my dead body will you ever get my job." What he heard from Dr. Stone after that was a rather curt note in which Fuzzy said he needed to search his soul regarding his personal debt to Dr. Larch, and his perhaps larger debt to society and to all the murdered unborn of the future. It was hard, Fuzzy implied, to listen to his conscience and not turn in Dr. Larch. "To the authorities," he added ominously. What a good story, thought Wilbur Larch. It had taken him the rest of August 1940-something. He wanted to leave the matter all set up, all arranged, when Homer Wells returned to St. Cloud's from his summer job. Wilbur Larch had created a replacement for himself, one who would be acceptable to the authorities, whoever they were. He had created someone with qualified obstetrical procedure and, what better, an orphan familiar with the place from birth. He had also created a perfect lie, because the Dr. F. Stone whom Wilbur Larch had in mind would perform abortions, of course, while at the same time, what better, he would be on record for claiming he was against performing them. When Larch retired, or he knew, if he was ever caught, he would already have available his most perfect replacement. Of course, Larch was not through with Fuzzy. Such an important replacement might require some revision. Wilbur Larch lay in the dispensary with both the stars of Maine and the stars of ether circling around him. He had given Fuzzy Stone a role in life that was much more strenuous than Fuzzy ever could have been capable of. How could poor Fuzzy even have imagined it, as he succumbed to the failure of his breathing contraption? Only one problem, thought Wilbur Larch, dreaming with the stars. How do I get Homer to play the part? Homer Wells, gazing at the actual stars of Maine and at the orchards visible in the waning moonlight out Wally's window, saw something glint, something beyond the orchard from which he knew the ocean could be viewed. Homer moved his head up and down in Wally's window, and the glint flashed to him. The feeble signal reminded him of the night when the deep Maine woods had not returned his voice to him, when he had yelled his echoless good night to Fuzzy Stone. Then he realized where the glint was coming from. There must be one small polished spot on the tin roof of the cider house. He was seeing the waning moon bounce off the roof of the cider house, off a spot no bigger than a knife blade. This little glint in the night was one of those things that, even after you identify it, you can't leave alone. It was no help to him to listen to Wally's peaceful breathing. The problem is, Homer Wells knew, I am in love with Candy. It was Candy who suggested he not go back to St. Cloud's. "My father likes you so much," she told Homer. "I know he'll give you a job on the boat or in the pound." "My mother likes you so much," Wally had added. "I know she'll keep you on in the orchards, especially through harvest. And she gets lonely whenever I go back to college. I'll bet she'd be delighted to have you stay right where you are, in my room." Out in the orchards, the roof of the cider house flashed to him. The flash was as small and as quick as the one glimpse of an eye-tooth Grace Lynch had revealed. Her mouth had parted only that much when she'd last looked at him. "How could I not be in love with Candy?" he wondered. "And if I stay here," he asked himself, "what can I do?" The roof of the cider house flashed, then it stood dark and still. He had seen the wink of the curette before it went to work. He had seen it at rest in the examining tray, dull with blood, in need of cleaning. "And if I go back to St. Cloud's," he asked himself, "what can I do?" In Nurse Angela's office, on the new typewriter, Dr. Larch began a letter to Homer Wells. "I remember nothing so vividly as kissing you," Dr. Larch began, but he stopped. He knew he couldn't say that. He pulled the page from the typewriter, then he hid it deep within a brief history of St. Cloud's, as if it were another particle of history without an audience. David Copperfield had a fever when he'd gone to bed, and Larch went to check on the boy. Larch was relieved to feel that young Copperfield's fever had broken. The boy's forehead was cool, and a slight sweat chilled the boy's neck, which Larch carefully rubbed dry with a towel. There was not much moonlight. Therefore, Larch felt unobserved. He bent over Copperfield and kissed him, much in the manner that he remembered kissing Homer Wells. Larch moved to the next bed and kissed Smoky Fields, who tasted vaguely like hot dogs. Yet the experience was soothing.